She wouldn't be working with you after 7 years if you weren't a great agent. I know I'm a great agent. That's not the problem. The problem is I'm embarrassed, ashamed, and a little hurt. Because, as it turns out, I do have feelings. It's fine. I'm fine. Charlie studies me. I'm fine, I say again.
Clearly.
You're laughing now, but I'm not laughing, he interjects.
When did I laugh?
Good point. I'm sure that's never happened. But just you wait until one of your authors turns in a book about an amber-eyed asshole editor.
Amber-eyed?
He says. I notice you didn't question the asshole part of that sentence, I say, and chug some more. Clearly, the filter has melted away again, but at least that's proof I'm not the woman in those pages.
I'm used to people thinking I'm an asshole, he says stiffly. Less used to them describing my eyes as amber.
That's what color they are, I say. It's objective. I'm not complimenting you.
Well, in that case, I'll abstain from being flattered. What color are yours?
He leans in without any hint of embarrassment, only curiosity, his warm breath feathering over my jaw. That's pretty much when I realize I think he's hot. I mean, I know I thought he was hot in Mug and Shot when I thought he was someone else, but this is when I realize I think he, specifically Charlie Lastra, not just someone who looks like him, is hot. I take another sip. Red.
Really brings out the color of your forked tail and horns.
You're too sweet.
Now that, he says, is something I've never been accused of.
I can't imagine why not. He arches a brow, that honey gold ring around his black hole pupils glinting.
And I'm sure people line up to recite sonnets about your sweetness.
I scoff. My sister's the sweet one. If she pees outside, flower gardens burst up from it.
You know, he says, Sunshine Falls might not be the big city, but you should let your sister know we do have indoor plumbing. Pretty much the only thing Dusty got right.
Shoot. I grab my phone. Dusty. She's in a vulnerable place, and she's used to me being 100% accessible. Whether this book makes me look like the Countess Bathory or not, I owe it to her to do my job. I start typing a reply, using an uncharacteristic excess of exclamation points. Charlie checks his watch.
9 o'clock, on vacation, in a bar, and you're still working. Nadine Winters would be proud.
You're one to judge, I say. I happen to know your Loja Publishing email account has had plenty of action this week.
Yes, but I have no problem with Nadine Winters, he says. In fact, I find her fascinating.
My eyes catch on the word I'm typing. Oh? What's so interesting about a sociopath?
Patricia Highsmith might have something to say about that, he replies. But more importantly, Nora, don't you think you're judging this character a little too harshly? It's 10 pages.
I sign the message, hit send, and swivel back to him, my knees locking into place between his. Because, as we all know, reviewers are notoriously kind to female characters.
Well, I like her. Who the fuck cares whether anyone else does, as long as they want to read about her?
People also slow down to gawk at car wrecks, Charlie. Are you calling me a car wreck?
I'm not talking about you at all, he says. I'm talking about Nadine Winters, my fictional crush.
A feeling like a scorching hot slinky drops through me. Big fan of jet black hair and Krav Maga, huh? Charlie leans forward, face serious, voice low.
It's more about the blood dripping from her fangs.
I'm unsure how to respond. Not because it's gross, but because I'm pretty sure he's making a reference to the shark of it all, and that feels dangerously close to flirting. And I should definitely not be flirting with him. For all I know, he has a partner, or a doll room, and then there's the fact that publishing is a small pond, and one wrong move could easily pollute it. God, even my internal dialogue sounds like Nadine.
I clear my throat, take a sip of beer, and force myself not to overthink the way I'm sitting tucked between his thighs or how my eyes keep zeroing in on that crease beneath his lip. I don't need to overthink. I don't need to be in complete control. "So tell me about this place," I say. "What's interesting here?"
"Do you like grass?"
Charlie asks. "Big fan."
"We've got lots."
"What else?" I ask.
"We made a BuzzFeed list of the top 10 most repulsively named restaurants in America."
"Been there," I wave to our general surroundings. "Done that." He tips his chin toward me.
"You tell me, Nora, do you think this place is interesting?"
"It's certainly," I search for the word, "peaceful." He laughs. A husky, jagged sound, one that belongs in a crammed Brooklyn bar, the streetlights beyond the rain-streaked window tinting his golden skin reddish. Not here.
"Is that a question?"
he says. "It's peaceful," I say more confidently.
"So you just don't like peaceful?"
He's smirking through his pout, smirting.
"You'd rather be somewhere loud and crowded, where just existing feels like a competition."
I've always considered myself an introvert, but the truth is I'm used to having people on all sides of me. You adapt to living life with a constant audience. It becomes comforting. Mom used to say she became a New Yorker the day she openly wept on the subway. She'd gotten cut in the final round of an audition, and an old lady across the train car had handed her a tissue without even looking up from her book. The way my mind keeps springing back to New York seems to prove his point. Once again, I'm unnerved by the feeling that Charlie Lastra sees right through my carefully pressed outermost layers. "I'm perfectly happy with peace and quiet," I insist.
"Maybe."
Charlie twists to grab his beer, the movement pressing his outside knee into mine just long enough for him to take another sip before he faces me again.
"Or maybe, Nora Stevens, I can read you like a book."
I scoff. "Because you're so socially intelligent."
"Because you're like me."
A zing shoots up from where his knee brushes mine. "We're nothing alike."
"You're telling me," Charlie says, "that from the moment you stepped off the airplane, you haven't been itching to get back to New York, feeling like you're an astronaut out in space while the world's just turning at a normal speed, and by the time you get back, you'll have missed your whole life? Like New York will never need you like you need it?"
"Exactly," I think, stunned for the 45th time in as many minutes. I smooth my hair, like I can tuck any exposed secrets back into place. "Actually, the last couple days have been a refreshing break from all the surly, monochromatic New York literary types." Charlie's head tilts, his lids heavy.
"Do you know you do that?"
"Do what?" I say. His fingers brush the right corner of my mouth.
"Get a divot here when you lie."
I slap his hand out of the air, but not before all the blood in my body rushes to meet his fingertips. "That's not my lying divot," I lie. "It's my annoyed divot."
"On that note," he says dryly, "how about a game of high-stakes poker?"
"Fine." I take another slug of beer. "It's my lying divot. Sue me. I miss New York, and it's too quiet here for me to sleep, and I'm very disappointed that the general store is actually a pawn shop. Is that what you want to hear, Charlie? That my vacation is not off to an auspicious start?"
"I'm always a fan of the truth," he says.
"No one's always a fan of the truth," I say. "Sometimes the truth sucks."
"It's always better to have the truth up front than to be misled."
"There's still something to be said for social niceties."
"Ah."
He nods, eyes glinting knowingly.
"For example, waiting until after lunch to tell someone you hate their client's book?"
"It wouldn't have killed you," I say.
"It might have," he says. "As we learned from Old Man Whitaker, secrets can be toxic."
I straighten as something occurs to me. "That's why you hated it, because you're from here." Now he shifts uncomfortably. I've found a weakness. I've seen through one of Charlie Lastra's outermost layers, and the scales tip ever so slightly in my favor. Big fan. Huge. Let me guess. I jut out my bottom lip. Bad memories. Or maybe, he drawls, leaning in.
It has something to do with the fact that Dusty Fielding clearly hasn't even Googled Sunshine Falls in the last 20 years, let alone visited.
Of course, he has a point, but as I study the irritable rigidity of his jaw and the strangely sensual, though distinctly grim set of his lips, I know my smile's sharpening. Because I see it, the half-truth of his words. I can read him, too, and it feels like I've discovered a latent superpower. Come on, Charlie, I prod. I thought you were always a fan of the truth. Let it out. He scowls, still pouting, so scouting?
So I'm not this place's biggest fan.
Wow, I sing. All this time I thought you hated the book, but really you just had a deep, dark secret that made you close off from love and joy and laughter and, oh my God, you are Old Man Whittaker.
Okay, maestro.
Charlie plucks the beer bottle I'd been gesticulating with from my hand, setting it safely on the bar.
Chill. I've just never liked those everything is better in small towns narratives. My darkest secret is that I believed in Santa Claus until I was 12.
You say that like it isn't incredible blackmail.
Mutually assured destruction.
He taps my phone, an allusion to the frigid document.
I'm just evening the field for you after those pages.
How noble. Now tell me why your day was so bad. He studies me for a moment, then shakes his head.
No, I don't think I will. Not until you tell me why you're really here.
I already told you, I say. Vacation. He leans in again, his hand catching my chin, his thumb landing squarely on the divot at the corner of my lips. My breath catches. His voice is low and raspy.
Liar.
His fingertips fall away, and he gestures to the bartender for two more beers. I don't stop him, because I am not Nadine Winters. 7.
How about, Charlie says, a game of pool. If I win, you tell me why you're really here, and if you do, I'll tell you about my day.
I snort and look away, hiding my lying dimple as I tuck my phone into my bag, having confirmed Libby made it home safely. I don't play. Or I haven't since college, when my roommate and I used to shark frat boys weekly.
Darts, Charlie suggests.
I arch a brow. You want to hand me a weapon after the turn my night has taken? He leans close, eyes shining in the dim bar lighting.
I'll play left-handed.
Maybe I don't want to hand you a weapon either, I say. His eye roll is subtle, more of a twitch of some key face muscles.
Left-handed pool, then.
I study him. Neither of us blinks. We're basically having a sixth-grade-style staring contest, and the longer it goes on, the more the air seems to thrum with some metaphysical buildup of energy. I slink off my stool and drain my second beer. Fine. We make our way back to the only open table. It's darker on this side of the restaurant, the floor stickier with spilled booze, and the smell of beer emanates from the walls. Charlie grabs a pool cue and a rack and starts gathering the balls in the center of the felt table.
You know the rules?
He asks, peering up at me as he leans across the green surface. One of us is stripes and one of us is solids? I say. He takes the blue chalk cube from the edge of the table and works it over the pool cue.
You want to go first?
You're going to teach me, right? I'm trying to look innocent, to look like Libby batting her eyelashes. Charlie stares at me.
I really wonder what you think your face is doing right now, Stevens.
I narrow my eyes. He narrows his back exaggeratedly. Why do you care why I'm here? I ask.
Morbid curiosity. Why do you care about my bad day?
Always helpful to know your opponent's weaknesses. He holds the cue out.
You first.
I take the stick, flop it onto the edge of the table, and look over my shoulder. Isn't now the part where you're supposed to put your arms around me and show me how to do it? His mouth curves.
That depends. Are you carrying any weapons?
The sharpest thing on me is my teeth. I settle over the cue, holding it like I've not only never played pool before, but have quite possibly only just discovered my own hands. Charlie's smell, warm and uncannily familiar, invades my nose as he positions himself behind me, barely touching. I can feel the front of his sweater graze my bare spine, my skin tingling at the friction, and his arms fold around mine as his mouth drops beside my ear.
Loosen your grip.
His low voice vibrates through me, his breath warm on my jaw as he pries my fingers from the cue and readjusts them.
The front hand's for aiming. You're not going to move it. The momentum.
His palm scrapes down my elbow until he catches my wrist and drags it back along the cue toward my hip.
We'll come from here. You just want to keep the stick straight when you're starting out, and aim as if you're lining up perfectly with the ball you want to sink.
Got it, I say. His hands slide clear of me, and I will the goosebumps on my skin to settle as I line up my shot. One thing I forgot to mention. I snap the stick into the cue ball, sending the solid blue one across the table into the pocket. Is that I did used to play. I walk past Charlie to line up my next shot.
And here I thought I was just a really good teacher, he says flatly.
I pocket the green ball next, and then miss the burgundy one. When I chance a glance at him, he looks not only unsurprised, but downright smug, like I've proven a point. He pulls the cue from my hands and circles the table, eyeing several options for his first shot before choosing the green striped ball and getting into position.
And I guess I should have mentioned.
He taps the cue ball, which sends the green striped ball into a pocket, the purple striped ball sinking right behind it.
I'm left-handed.
I jam my mouth closed when he looks at me on his way to line up his next shot. This time, he pockets the orange-striped ball, then the burgundy one, before finally missing on his next turn. He sticks his lip out like I did when I teased him about bad memories.
Would it help the sting if I bought you another beer?
I yank the stick from his hand. Make it a martini and get yourself one, too. You're going to need it. Charlie wins the first game, so one game becomes two. I win that one, and he is unwilling to tie, so we play a third. When he wins, he pulls the cue out of my reach before I can demand a fourth match.
Nora, he says, we had a deal.
I never agreed to it.
You played, he says.
I tip my head back, groaning.
If it helps, he says with his signature dryness, I'm willing to sign an NDA before you tell me about whatever deep, dark, twisted fantasy brought you here.
I slit my eyes. He moves my glass off the cocktail napkin and feels around in his pockets until he finds a Pilot G2. Admittedly, my own pen of choice, though I always use black ink and he's got the traditional editor red. He leans over and scribbles, I, Charles Lastra, of sound mind, do swear I will keep Nora Stevens' dark, dirty, twisted secret under penalty of law or $5 million, whichever comes first. Okay, you've absolutely never seen a contract, I say. Maybe never been in the same room as one. He finishes signing and drops the pen.
That's a fine fucking contract.
Poor, uninformed book editors with their whimsical notions of how agreements are made. I pat his head. He swats my arm away.
What could possibly be so bad, Nora? Are you on the run? Did you rob a bank?
In the dark, the gold of his eyes looks strangely light against his oversized pupils.
Did you fire your pregnant assistant?
He teases, voice low. The illusion is a shock to my system, a jolt of electricity from head to toe. Miraculously, I'd forgotten about Dusty's pages. Now, here Nadine is again, taunting me. "What's so wrong with being in control anyway?" I demand of the universe at large.
"Beats me."
"And what, just because I don't want kids, I would supposedly punish a pregnant woman for making a different decision than me? My favorite person's a pregnant woman, and I'm obsessed with my nieces. Not every decision a woman makes is some grand indictment on other women's lives."
"Nora," Charlie says, "it's a novel. Fiction."
"You don't get it because you're... you." I wave a hand at him.
"Me?"
he says. "You can afford to be all surly and sharp, and people will admire you for it. The rules are different for women. You have to strike this perfect balance to be taken seriously, but not seen as bitchy. It's a constant effort. People don't want to work with sharky women."
"I do,"
he says. "And even men exactly like us don't want to be with us. I mean, sure, some of them think they do, but next thing you know, they're dumping you in a 4-minute phone call because they've never seen you cry and moving across the country to marry a Christmas tree heiress." Charlie's full lips press into a knot, his eyes squinting.
"What?"
"Nothing," I grumble.
"A very specific nothing."
"Forget it."
"Not likely," he says. "I'm going to be up all night making diagrams and charts trying to figure out what you just said."
"I'm cursed," I say. "That's all."
"Oh," he says. "Sure, got it."
"I am," I insist.
"I'm an editor, Stevens," he says. "I'm going to need more details to buy into this narrative."
"It's my literary stock character," I say. "I'm the cold-blooded, overly ambitious city slicker who exists as a foil to the good woman. I'm the one who gets dumped for the girl who's prettier without makeup and loves barbecue and somehow makes destroying a karaoke standard seem adorable." And for some reason, my low alcohol tolerance, it doesn't stop there. It comes spilling out like I'm just puking up embarrassing history onto the peanut shell-littered floor for everyone to see. Aaron dumping me for Prince Edward Island, and confirmed via light social media stalking, a redhead named Adeline. Grant breaking up with me for chastity and her parents' little inn. Luca and his wife and their cherry farm in Michigan. When I reach patient zero, Jacob, the novelist turned rancher, I cut myself off. What happened between him and me doesn't belong at the end of a list. It belongs where I left it. In the smoking crater that changed my life forever. You get the idea. His eyes slit, an amused tilt to his lips.
Do I, though?
Tropes and cliches have to come from somewhere, right? I say. Women like me have clearly always existed, so it's either a very specific kind of self-sabotage or an ancient curse. Come to think of it, maybe it started with Lilith. Too weird to be coincidence.
You know, Charlie says, I'd say Dusty writing a whole-ass book about my hometown and then me running into her agent in said town is too weird to be a coincidence, but as we've already established, you're not stalking me, so coincidences do occasionally happen, Nora.
But this? 4 relationships ending because my boyfriend's decided to walk off into the wilderness and never come back? He's fighting a smirk, but losing the battle. I'm not ridiculous, I say, laughing despite myself.
Okay, because of myself. Exactly what a not ridiculous person would say,
Charlie allows with a nod.
Look, I'm still trying to figure out how your shitty Jack London wannabe ex-boyfriends factor into why you're here.
My sisters... I consider for a moment, then settle on... Things have been kind of off between us for the last few months, and she wanted to get away for a while. Plus, she reads too many small-town romance novels and is convinced the answer to our problems is having our own transformative experiences, like my exes did, in a place like this.
Your exes,
he says bluntly.
Who gave up their careers and moved to the wilderness.
Yes, those ones.
So what?
He says.
You're supposed to find happiness here and ditch New York? Quit publishing?
Of course not, I say. She just wants to have fun before the baby comes. take a break from our usual lives and do something new. We have a list.
A list?
A bunch of things from the books. And this is why I don't drink 2 martinis. Because even at 5'11", my body is incapable of processing alcohol, as evidenced by the fact that I start listing. Wear flannel, bake something from scratch, get small-town makeovers, build something, date some locals. Charlie laughs brusquely.
She's trying to marry you off to a pig farmer, Stevens.
She is not.
You said she's trying to give you your own small-town romance novel,
he says wryly.
You know how those books end, don't you, Nora? With a big wedding inside of a barn, or an epilogue involving babies.
I scoff. Of course I know how they end. Not only have I watched my exes live them, but when Libby and I still shared an apartment, I'd read the final pages of her books almost compulsively. That never really tempted me to turn back to page 1.
Look, Lastra, I say. My sister and I are here to spend time together. You probably didn't learn this in whatever lab spawned you, but vacations are a fairly typical way for loved ones to bond and relax.
Yes, because if anything's going to relax a person like you, he says, it's spending time in a town conveniently situated between 2 equidistant dress barns.
You know, I'm not as much of an uptight control freak as either you or Dusty seem to think. I could have a perfectly nice time on a date with a pig farmer. And you know what? Maybe it's a good idea. It's not like I've had any luck with New Yorkers. Maybe I have been fishing in the wrong pond, or like the wrong stream of nuclear waste runoff.
You, he says, are so much weirder than I thought.
Well, for what it's worth, before tonight, I assumed you went into a broom closet and entered power-saving mode whenever you weren't at work, so I guess we're both surprised.
Now you're being ridiculous, he says. When I'm not at work, I'm in my coffin in the basement of an old Victorian mansion.
I snort into my glass, which makes him crack a real human smile. It lives, I think.
Stevens, he says, tone dry once more. If you're the villain in someone else's love story, then I'm the devil.
You said it, not me, I reply. He lifts a brow.
You're scrappy tonight.
I'm always scrappy, I say. Tonight I'm just not bothering to hide it.
Good.
He leans in, dropping his voice, and an electric current charges through me.
I've always preferred to have things out in the open, though the pig farmers of Sunshine Falls might not feel the same way.
His gaze flicks sidelong toward mine, his scent vaguely spicy and familiar. An unwelcome heaviness settles between my thighs. I really hope my chin divot hasn't found a way to announce that I'm turned on. I already told you, I say. I'm here for my sister. And as much anxiety as I feel being away from home, the truth is, I spend the length of Libby's pregnancies in a low-grade panic anyway. At least this way, I can keep an eye on her. I never dreamed of having my own kids, but the way I felt during Libby's first pregnancy really sealed the deal. There are just too many things that can go wrong, too many ways to fail. I pitch myself onto a stool at the corner of the bar and almost fall over in the process. Charlie catches my arms and steadies me.
How about some water?
He says, sliding onto the empty stool beside mine, that suppressed smirk, pout, what even is this, tugging his full lips slightly to one side as he signals to the bartender. I square my shoulders, trying for dignified. You're not going to distract me. His brow lifts.
From?
I won one of those games. You owe me information. Especially given the horrifying amount I just blurted out. His head tilts, and he peers down his face at me.
What do you want to know?
Our lunch 2 years ago pops into my head, Charlie's irritated glance at his watch. You said you were trying to catch a flight the day we met. Why? He scratches at his collar, his brow furrowing, jaw etched with tension.
The same reason I'm here now.
Intriguing.
I promise it's not.
Waters have appeared on the bar. He turns one in place, his jaw tensing.
My dad had a stroke, one back then and another a few months ago. I'm here to help.
Shit. Wow. Immediately, my vision clears and sharpens on him, my buzz burning off. You were so together.
I made a commitment to be there, he says with a defensive edge, and I didn't see how talking about it would be productive.
I wasn't saying, look, I'd gotten dumped like 46 seconds earlier, and I still sat down for a martini and a salad with a perfect stranger, so I get it.
Charlie's eyes snag on mine, so intense I have to look away for a second.
Is your dad okay?
He turns his glass again.
When we had lunch, I already knew he wasn't in danger. My sister had just told me about the stroke, but it actually happened weeks earlier.
His face hardens.
He decided I didn't need to know, and that was that.
He shifts on his stool, the discomfort of someone who's just decided he's overshared. Even factoring in the gin and beer sloshing around in my body, I'm shocked to hear myself blurt, "Our dad left us when my mom was pregnant. I don't really remember him. After that, it was pretty much a parade of loser boyfriends, so I'm not really an expert on dads."
Charlie's brows pinch, his fingers stilling on his damp glass.
"Sounds terrible."
"It wasn't too bad," I say. "She never let most of them meet us. She was good about that."
I reach for my glass, trying his tick, turning it in a ring of its own sweat.
"But one day she'd be floating on a cloud, singing her favorite Hello Dolly songs and fluffing embroidered thrift store pillows like Snow White in New York, and the next..."
I don't trail off so much as just outright cut myself off. I'm not ashamed of my upbringing, but the more you tell a person about yourself, the more power you hand over. And I particularly avoid sharing mom with strangers. Like, the memory of her is a newspaper clipping, and every time I take it out, she fades and creases a little more. Charlie's thumb slides over my wrist absently.
"Stevens,
I don't need you to feel sorry for me."
His pupils dilate.
"I wouldn't dare."
A dare is exactly what his voice sounds like. At some point, we've drawn together, my legs tucked between his again, an endless buzzing feedback loop everywhere we're touching. His eyes are heavy on me, his pupils almost blotting out his irises, a lustrous ring of honey around a deep, dark pit. Heat gathers between my thighs, and I uncross and recross my legs. Charlie's eyes drop to follow the motion, and his water glass hitches against his bottom lip, like he's forgotten what he was doing. In that moment, he is 100% legible to me. I might as well be looking into a mirror. I could lean into him. I could let my knees slide further into the pocket between his, or touch his arm, or tip my chin up, and in any of those hypothetical scenarios, we end up kissing. I may not like him all that much, but a not insignificant part of me is dying to know what his bottom lip feels like, how that hand on my wrist would touch me. Just then, it starts to rain, pour, and the corrugated metal roof erupts into a feverish rattle. I jerk my arm out from under Charlie's and stand. "I should get home."
"Share a cab?"
he asks, his voice low, gravelly. The odds of finding two cabs at this hour in this town aren't great. The odds of finding one that isn't driven by Hardy are terrible. "I think I'll walk."
"In this rain?"
he says.
"And those shoes?"
I grab my bag. "I won't melt." "Probably." Charlie stands.
"We can share my umbrella."
8. We make our way out of Papa's squats, huddled under Charlie's umbrella. I'd called it fortuitous, but it turns out he checks a weather app obsessively, so apparently I've found someone even more predictable than I am. The smell of grass and wildflowers is thick in the damp air, and it's cooled considerably. He asks,
"Where are you staying?"
"It's called Good's Lily Cottage," I say.
He says, almost to himself,
"Bizarre."
Heat creeps up my neck from where his breath hits it. What, I couldn't possibly be happy anywhere that isn't a black marble penthouse with a crystal chandelier?
Exactly what I meant.
He casts a look my way as we pass under a bar of streetlight, the rain sparkling like silver confetti.
And also, it's my parents' rental property.
My cheeks flush. You're Sally Goods, your mom? You grew up next to a horse farm?
What? He says. I couldn't possibly have been raised anywhere but a black marble penthouse with a crystal chandelier.
Just hard to imagine you belonging anywhere in this town, let alone so close to a manure pyramid.
Belonging might be overstating things,
he says acidly. So where are you staying?
Well, I usually stay at the cottage,
he says, another sidelong glance at me through the dark.
But that wasn't an option.
His smell is so uncannily familiar, but I still can't place it. Warm, with a slightly spicy edge, faint enough that I keep catching myself trying to inhale a lungful of it. Then where? I ask. Your childhood bedroom? We pause at the dead-end street the cottage sits on, and Charlie sighs.
I'm sleeping in a race car bed, Nora. Are you happy?
Happy doesn't begin to cover it. The image of stern-browed, highly polished Charlie tucked into a plastic Corvette and scowling at his Kindle makes me laugh so hard it's a struggle to stay upright. He's probably the last person I could picture in a race car bed, aside from myself. Charlie hooks an arm around my waist as I keel over.
Little reminder,
he says, keeping me moving down the gravel lane.
That is far from the most embarrassing thing one of us has said tonight.
I get out. Were you, like, a NASCAR kid?
No, he says. But my dad never stopped trying.
I devolve into another fit of laughter that threatens to tip me over. Charlie pulls me against his side.
1 foot in front of the other, Stevens.
Mutually assured destruction, indeed, I cry. He starts to lead me up the hillside, and immediately my heel sinks into the mud, pinning me to the ground. I take another step, and the other heel punctures the mud, too. An indignant half-shriek rises out of me. Charlie stops, sighing heavily as he eyes my shoes.
Am I going to have to carry you?
I am not letting you give me a piggyback ride, Lastra, I say.
And I, he replies, I'm not letting you destroy those poor, innocent shoes. I'm not that kind of man.
I look at my mules, and a miserably petulant sound squeaks out of me. Fine.
You're welcome.
He turns and hunches as I hike up my dress and say a fond farewell to the last remnants of my dignity, then hook my arms over his shoulders and hop onto his back.
All good,
he says. I'm getting a piggyback ride. I reply, adjusting the umbrella over us. Does that answer your question?
Poor Nora,
he teases, his hands settling against my thighs as he starts up the steps.
I can only imagine what you're going through.
A realization clangs through me, chaotic and emphatic as church bells. The reason his smell is so familiar. It's the same subtle, gender-neutral cologne I wear. A cedarwood and amber blend called Book, meant to summon images of sun-bathed shelves and worn pages. When I found out the company was going under, I put in a bulk order so I could stockpile it. I would have placed it sooner, but it smells different on him. The way Mom's signature lemon lavender scent hits different on Libby, a note of vanilla drawn out that was never there before. Charlie's rendition of Book is spicier, warmer than mine.
Awfully quiet back there, Stevens, he says. Anything I can do to make your journey more comfortable? A neck pillow? Some of those tiny Delta cookies?
I take some spurs and a riding crop, I say.
Should have seen that coming,
he grumbles. I'd also accept a sworn affidavit that we'll never speak of this again.
After the way you disparaged my last contract, I don't think so.
When we reach the front steps, I slide off Charlie's back and try to pull my dress back into place, which is a struggle because I didn't do an amazing job of keeping the umbrella over us, and we're both fairly drenched, my dress plastered to my thighs and bangs stuck to my eyes. Charlie reaches out to brush them away.
Nice haircut, by the way.
Straight men love bangs, I say. They make women approachable.
Nothing more intimidating than a forehead, he says. Although I sort of miss the blonde.
And there it is, that mushroom cloud of want low in my belly, a twinge between my thighs. It's not natural, I announce.
Didn't think it was,
he says.
But it suits you.
Because it looks vaguely evil, I guess. He splits into a rare full grin, but only for a second, just long enough to send my stomach flipping.
I've been thinking.
I'll call a news crew immediately.
You should scratch number 5.
Number 5?
On the list.
I palm my face. Why did I tell you about that?
Because you wanted someone to stop you from going through with it,
he says.
The last thing you need is to get mixed up with someone who lives here.
I drop my hand and narrow my eyes at him. Do they eat outsiders?
Worse,
he says.
They keep them here forever.
I scoff. Lasting commitment. How terrible.
Nora,
he says, tone low and chiding.
You and I both know that you don't want that epilogue. Someone like you, in shoes like that, could never be happy here. Don't get some poor pig farmer's hopes up for nothing.
Okay, rude, I say.
Rude.
He steps in closer, the searing fluorescent light over the door casting him in stark relief, etching out the hollows beneath his cheekbones and making his eyes gleam.
Rude is declaring the entire dating pool of New York City tainted just because you managed to pick 4 assholes in a row.
My throat warms, a lump of lava sliding down it. Don't tell me I hurt your feelings. I murmur.
You of all people should know,
he says, gaze dropping to my mouth.
We surly, monochromatic literary types don't have those.
In my head, Nadine Winters's voice is screaming, abort, abort, this fits into no plan. But there's a lot of rushing blood and tingling skin for the words to compete with. I don't remember doing it. But my fingers are pressed against his stomach, his muscles tightening under them. Bad idea, I think, in the split second before Charlie tugs my hips flush to his. The words break apart like alphabet soup, letters splintering off in every direction, utterly meaningless now. His mouth catches mine roughly as he eases me back into the cottage door, covering my body with his. I half moan at the pressure. His hands tighten on my waist. My lips part for his tongue, the tang of beer and the herbal edge of gin tangling pleasantly in my mouth. It feels like my outline is dissolving, like I'm turning to liquid. His mouth skates down my jaw, over my throat. My hands scrape through his coarse, rain-soaked hair, and he lets out a low groan, his hand trailing to my chest, fingers brushing over my nipple. At some point, the umbrella has clattered to the ground. Charlie's shirt is plastered to him. He palms me through my damp dress, making me arch. Our mouths slip together. The last dregs of beer and gin evaporate from my bloodstream, and everything is happening in high definition. My hands skim up the back of his shirt, fingernails sinking into his smooth, warm skin, urging him closer, and his palm moves to the hem of my dress, shucking it up my thigh. His fingers glide higher, sending chills rippling over my skin, and something like weight just barely, half-heartedly slips out of me. I'm not even sure how he heard it, but Charlie jerks back, looking like a man freshly out of a trance, hair mussed, lips bee-stung, dark eyes blinking rapidly.
Shit,
he says, hoarse, stepping back.
I didn't mean to.
Clarity hits me with a cold water shock. Shit is right.
As in, I don't shit where I eat or kiss where I work. It's bad enough that in a year and a half, everyone I work with is going to think of me as Nadine Winters. I don't need to add any more potential fuel to my reputation's funeral pyre. He says,
I can't really get involved.
I don't need an explanation. I cut him off, yanking the hem of my dress back down my thighs. It was a mistake.
I know,
Charlie says, sounding vaguely offended. Well, I know too.
Fine, he says. Then we agree.
Fine, I cry, continuing recorded history's strangest and least productive argument. Charlie hasn't moved. Neither of us has. His eyes are still inky dark and hungry, and thanks to the light bulb over the door, his hard-on might as well be in a display case at a particularly lascivious museum. I take a breath. Let's just act like, at the same time, he says,
we should pretend it never happened.
I nod. He nods. It's settled. He grabs his umbrella off the ground, and neither of us bothers with goodnight. He just nods again stiffly and turns and walks away. It never happened, I think, with some force. Which is good, because my reckless decisions always have disastrous consequences. 9. When I was 12, my mother was cast in a crime procedural. She hit it off with the showrunner. Before long, she was seeing him nightly. 4 episodes into filming, he reconciled with his estranged wife. Mom's plucky young detective character was swiftly killed off, her body discovered in a meat locker. I'd never seen Mom quite so distraught. We avoided whole swaths of the city afterward, dodging any place she might run into him, or be reminded of him, or of the job she'd lost. After that, it was an easy decision for me to never fall in love. For years, I stuck by it. Then I met Jacob. He made the world open up around me, like there were colors I'd never seen, new levels of happiness I couldn't have imagined. Mom was ecstatic when I told her I was moving in with him. After everything she'd been through, she was still a romantic. He's going to take such good care of you, sweet girl, she said. He was a couple of years older than me and had a well-paying bartending job and a tiny apartment uptown. A week later, I hugged Mom and Libby goodbye and schlepped my stuff to his place. 2 weeks after that, Mom was gone. The bills came due all at once. Rent, utilities, a credit card we'd opened in my name when things got particularly tight. Mom's credit was shot, and I wanted to help pull my weight. I'd been working at Freeman Books since I was 16, but I made minimum wage and could only manage part-time while I was in college, and someday the student loans I'd taken out would come back to haunt me. Mom's actor friends did a fundraiser for us, announcing after the funeral that they'd raised over $15,000, and Libby cried happy tears because she had no idea how little of a dent that would make. She'd been on a fashion design kick and wanted to go to Parsons, and I debated dropping out of my English program to fund her tuition, though I'd already sunk tens of thousands into mine. I moved out of Jacob's place and back in with Libby. I budgeted, scoured the internet for the cheapest, most filling meals, took on other jobs, tutoring, waitressing, outright writing classmates' papers. Jacob found out he'd gotten accepted into the Wyoming writing residency and left, and then there was the breakup, the utter desolation, the reminder of why the promise I'd made to myself years ago still mattered. I stopped dating, mostly. First dates were allowed, dinner only, and though I'd never tell anyone, the reason was that I'd have one less meal to pay for. 2, if I ordered enough to bring Libby leftovers. Second dates were a no-go. That's when the guilt kicked in, or the feelings did. Libby playfully heckled me about how no one was good enough for a second date. I let her. It would destroy me to hear what she thought of the truth. She worked too. Without Mom's income, we had to tighten our purse strings, but Libby never wanted to spend money on herself anyway. Sometimes, after complaining to her about a particularly bad date, though, I'd come home from classes or a tutoring shift to find her already asleep in her room. I'd moved out into the living room, where Mom used to sleep, so she could have the bedroom to herself, and a bundle of sunflowers sitting in a vase beside the pull-out couch. If I were normal, I might have cried. Instead, I'd sit there, clutching the vase, and just fucking shake. Like there were emotions deep in me, but too many layers of ash lay over them, deadening them to nothing but a tectonic murmur. There is a spot in my foot I can't feel. I stepped on a piece of glass, and the nerves there are dead now. The doctor said they'd grow back, but it's been years, and that place is still numb. That was how my heart had felt for years, like all the cracks calloused over. That enabled me to focus on what mattered. I built a life for me and Libby, a home that no bank or ex-boyfriend could ever take from us. I watched my friends in relationships make compromise after compromise, shrinking into themselves until they were nothing but a piece of a whole, until all their stories came from the past and their career aspirations, their friends, and their apartments were replaced by our aspirations, our friends, our apartment, half lives that could be taken from them without any warning. By then, I'd had all the practice and first dates that a person could get. I knew which red flags to watch for, the questions to ask. I'd seen my friends, coworkers, colleagues get ghosted, cheated on, bored in their relationships, and rudely awakened when partners turned out to be married or have gambling problems or be chronically unemployed. I saw casual hookups turn into miserably complicated half-relationships. I had standards and a life, and I wasn't about to let some man destroy it like it was merely the paper banner he was meant to crash through as he entered the field. So only once my career was on track did I start dating again, and this time I did it right, with caution, checklists, and carefully weighed decisions. I did not kiss colleagues. I did not kiss people I knew next to nothing about. I did not kiss men I had no intention of dating or men I was incompatible with. I didn't let random bouts of lust call the shots. Until Charlie Lastra. It never happened. I expected Libby to be giddy about my slip-up. Instead, she's as disapproving as I am.
"Your professional nemesis from New York does not count for number five, sissy," she says. "Couldn't you have made out with, like, a rodeo clown with a heart of gold?"
"I was wearing entirely the wrong shoes for that," I say.
"You could kiss a million Charlies back in the city. You're supposed to be trying new things here. We both are."
She brandishes the eggy spatula in my direction. Growing up, our apartment was a yogurt or granola bar breakfast home. But now Libby's a full English breakfast kind of gal, and there are already pancakes and veggie sausages stacked next to the egg pan. I fell out of bed at 9 after another restless night, took a run followed by a quick shower, then came down for breakfast. Libby's been up for hours already. She loves morning now even more than she loved sleeping as a teenager. Even on weekends, she never sleeps past 7. Partly, I'm sure, because she can hear Bee's high-pitched squeal or Tala's little pounding feet from 3 miles and a dose of morphine away. She always says the two of them are us, but body-swapped. Bee, the oldest, is sweet as cherry pie like Libby, but with my lankiness and ash-brown hair. Tala has her mother's strawberry gold hair and is destined to be no taller than 5'4", but like her Aunt Nono, she's a brute, opinionated and determined to never follow any command without a thorough explanation.
"You're the one who parent-trapped me with him," I point out, pulling the spatula from Libby's hand and ushering her toward a chair. "It never would have happened if you hadn't ditched me." "Look, Nora, sometimes even mommies need alone time," she says slowly. "Anyway, I thought you hated that guy."
"I don't hate him," I say. "We're just like opposing magnets or something."
Opposing magnets are the ones that draw together.
Okay, then we're magnets with the same polarity.
Two magnets with the same polarity would never make out against a door.
Unlike other magnets, which would definitely do that. I carry over our loaded plates, flopping into the chair across from her. It's already hellishly hot. We've got the windows open and the fans on, but it's as misty as a low-rent sauna. It was a moment of weakness. The memory of Charlie's hands on my waist, his chest flattening me into the door, sears through me. Libby arches an eyebrow. With her blunt pink bob, she's closer to mastering my own evil eye, but her cheeks are still, ultimately, too soft to get the job done.
Lest you forget, Sissy, that type of man has not worked out for you in the past.
Personally, I wouldn't lump Charlie in with my exes. For one thing, none of them ever tried to ravage me outside. Also, they never lurched out of a kiss like I'd shoved a hot fire poker down their pants.
I'm proud of you for going off book. I just wouldn't have chosen a hardcore groping by Count Von Lastra as the move.
I drop my face into my forearm, newly mortified. This is all Nadine Winters' fault. Libby's brow pinches.
Who?
Oh, that's right. I lift my head. In your desperation to see me barefoot and pregnant, you ran out before I could tell you. I unlock my phone and open the email from Dusty, sliding it into Libby's field of vision. She hunches as she reads, and I shovel food into my mouth as fast as I can so I can get my workday started. Libby's not a startlingly fast reader. She absorbs books like they're bubble baths, whereas my job has forced me to treat them more like hot and fast showers. Her mouth shrinks, tightening into a knot as she reads, until finally, she bursts into laughter.
Oh my God, she cries. It's Nora Stevens' fan fiction.
Can it really be called fan fiction if the author clearly isn't a fan? I say.
Has she sent you more? Does it get smutty? Lots of fan fiction gets smutty.
Again, I say, not fan fiction. Libby cackles.
Maybe Dusty's got a crush.
Or maybe she's hiring a hitman as we speak.
I hope it gets smutty, she says.
Libby, if you had your way, every book would end with an earth-shattering orgasm.
Hey, why wait until the end? She says. Oh, right, because that's where you start reading.
She pretends to dry heave at the thought. I stand to rinse my plate. Well, it's been fun, but I'm off to track down Wi-Fi that doesn't make me want to put my head through a wall.
I'll meet you later, she says. First, I'm going to spend a few hours walking around naked, shouting cuss words. Then I'll probably call home. Want me to tell Brendan you say hi?
Who? Libby flips me off. I loudly kiss the side of her head on my way to the door with my laptop bag.
Don't go anywhere from once in a lifetime without me, she screams.
I cut myself off before not sure those places even exist can spew out of me. For the first time in months, we feel like the us of a different time, fully connected, fully present, and the last thing I want is some uncontrollable variable messing things up. Promise, I say. 10. After paying for my iced Americano at Mug and Shot, I ask the chipper barista with the septum piercing for the Wi-Fi password.
Oh.
She gestures to a wooden sign behind her, reading, Let's Unplug.
No Wi-Fi here, sorry.
Wait, I say. Really? She beams.
Yep.
I glance around. No laptops in sight. Everyone here looks like they came straight from climbing Everest or doing drugs in a Coachella yurt. Is there a library or something? I ask. She nods.
A few blocks down. No Wi-Fi there yet, either. Supposed to get it in the fall. For now, they've got desktops you can use.
Is there anywhere in town with Wi-Fi? I ask.
The bookstore just got it,
she admits, quietly, like she's hoping the words don't trigger a stampede of coffee drinkers who would very much like to be unplugged. I thank her and emerge into the sticky heat,
sweat gathering in my armpits and cleavage as I trek toward the bookstore. When I step inside, it feels like I've just wandered into a maze, all the breezes, wind chimes, and bird chatter going quiet at once, that warm cedar and sunned paper smell folding around me. I sip my ice-cold drink and bask in the double-barreled serotonin coursing through me. Is there anything better than iced coffee and a bookstore on a sunny day? I mean, aside from hot coffee and a bookstore on a rainy day. The shelves are built at wild angles that make me feel like I'm sliding off the edge of the planet. As a kid, I would have loved the whimsy of it, a funhouse made of books. As an adult, I'm mostly concerned with staying upright. On the left, a low, rounded doorway is cut into one of the shelves, its frame carved with the words children's books. I bend to peer through it to a soft, blue-green mural, like something out of Madeline, words swirling across it, "Discover new worlds." Off the other side of the main room, an average-sized doorway leads to the used and rare book room. This main room isn't exactly brimming with crisp new spines. As far as I can tell, there's very little method to this store's organization. New books mixed with old, paperbacks with hardcovers, and fantasy next to nonfiction, a not-so-fine layer of dust laid over most of it. Once, I bet this place was a town jewel where people shopped for holiday presents and preteens gossiped over frappuccinos. Now, it's another small business graveyard. I follow the labyrinthine shelves deeper into the store, past a doorway to the world's most depressing cafe, a couple of card tables and some folding chairs, and around a corner, and I freeze for a millisecond, mid-step, 1 foot hovering in the air. Seeing the man hunched over his laptop behind the register, an unimpressed furrow in his brow, is like waking up from a nightmare where you're falling off a cliff, only to realize your house has been scooped up by a tornado while you slept. This is the problem with small towns. One minor lapse in judgment, and you can't go a mile without running into it. All I want to do is turn and hightail it, but I can't let myself do it. I won't let one slip-up, or any man, start governing my decisions. The whole reason to avoid workplace entanglements is to protect against this scenario. Besides, the entanglement was avoided. Mostly. I square my shoulders and raise my chin. In that moment, for the very first time, I wonder if I might have a guardian angel. Because directly across from me, on the local bestseller's shelf, sits a face-out stack of Once in a Lifetime. I grab a copy and march up to the counter. Charlie's gaze doesn't lift from his laptop until I've smacked the book onto the gouged mahogany. His golden brown eyes slowly rise.
Well, if it isn't the woman who isn't stalking me.
I grind out. If it isn't the man who didn't try to ravish me in the middle of a hurricane. His sip of coffee goes spewing back into his mug, and he glances toward the tragic cafe.
I certainly hope my high school principal was ready to hear that.
I lean sideways to peer through the doorway. At one of the card tables, a stooped, gray-haired woman is watching The Sopranos on a tablet with only one earbud in. Another one of your exes? That downward tick in the corner of his mouth.
I can tell you're pleased with yourself when your eyes go all predatory like that.
And I can tell you are when you do that lip twitch thing.
It's called a smile, Stevens. They're common here.
And by here, you must mean Sunshine Falls, because you definitely aren't referring to the 5-foot radius of your electric fence.
Have to keep the locals away somehow.
His eyes drop to the book.
Finally biting the bullet and reading the whole thing,
he says dryly. You know, I grab the book and hold it in front of my chest. I found this on the bestseller's shelf.
I know. It's shelved right next to The Guide to North Carolina's Bike Trails, my old dentist self-published last year,
he says.
Did you want one of those, too?
This book has sold more than 1 million copies, I tell him.
I'm aware.
He picks up the book.
But now I'm wondering how many of those you bought.
I scowl. He rewards me with an almost grin, and for the first time, I know exactly what my boss means when she describes my smile with knives. I look away from his face, which really just means my eyes skate down his golden throat and over his pristine white t-shirt to his arms. They're good arms. Not in a ripped way, just an attractively lean way. Okay, they're just arms. Chill, Nora. Straight men have it too easy. A heterosexual woman can see a very normal-looking, non-sexual appendage, and biology's like, step aside, last 4,000 years of evolution. It's time to contribute to the continuation of the human race. He brushes his laptop aside and starts rearranging the pens, pamphlets, and other office supplies on the desk. Maybe I'm not horny for him so much as his clothes and his organizational skills.
I was actually just emailing you.
I jolt back to the conversation, vibrating like a snapped rubber band.
Oh?
He nods, his jaw set, his eyes dark and intense.
Have you heard from Sharon yet?
Dusty's editor? He nods.
She's out on leave. Had her baby.
And just like that, all the lean arms, nice fingers, and perfectly organized jars of pens and highlighters in the world aren't enough to hold my attention.
But she's not due for another month, I say, panicked. We have another month to get Dusty edits.
Another small tick.
Would you like me to call her and tell her that? Maybe something could be done. Wait, do you have any connections at Mount Sinai Hospital?
Are you done? I ask. Or is there a second punchline to this hilarious joke?
Charlie's hands brace against the counter, and he leans forward, voice going raspy, eyes crackling with that strange internal lightning.
I want it.
I feel like I missed a step.
What?
Dusty's book. Frigid. I want to work on it.
Oh, thank God. I wasn't sure where that was going. And also, no way in hell.
If we want to keep the release date, Charlie goes on, Sharon won't be back in time to edit. Loja needs someone to step in, and I've asked to do it.
My mind feels less like it's spinning than like it's spinning 15 plates that are on fire. This is Dusty we're talking about. Shy, gentle Dusty, who's used to Sharon's soothing, optimistic demeanor. And you, who, no offense, are about as delicate as an antique pickaxe. His jaw muscles flex.
I know I don't have the best bedside manner, but I'm good at my job. I can do this, and you can get Dusty on board. The publisher doesn't want to bump back the release date. We need to push this thing through, no delays.
It's not my decision.
Dusty will listen to you, Charlie says. You could sell snake oil to a snake oil salesman.
I'm not sure that's how the saying goes.
I had to revise it to accurately reflect how good you are at your job.
My cheeks are on fire, less from the compliment than from a sudden, vivid memory of Charlie's mouth. The part where he staggered back from me like I'd shot him quickly follows. I swallow. I'll talk to her. That's all I can do. By habit, I've unthinkingly flipped the last page of Once. Now I thumb to the acknowledgments, letting my muscles relax at the sight of my name. It's proof that I am good at my job, that even if I can't control everything, there's a lot I can strong-arm into shape. I clear my throat. What are you doing here anyway? And how long do you have until the sunlight makes you burst into flames? Charlie folds his forearms on the counter.
Can you keep a secret, Stevens?
Ask me who shot JFK, I say, adopting his own deadpan tone. His eyes narrow.
Far more interested in how you got that information.
That one Stephen King book, I reply. Now, who are we keeping secrets from? He considers, teeth running over his full bottom lip. It's borderline lewd, but no worse than what's happening in my body right now.
Loja Publishing,
he replies. Okay, I consider. I can keep a secret from Loja, if you make it juicy. He leans in closer,
I follow suit. His whisper is so quiet, I almost have to press my ear to his mouth to hear it.
I work here.
You work here? I straighten up, blinking clear of the haze of his warm scent.
I work here,
he repeats, turning his laptop to reveal a PDF of a manuscript.
While I'm technically working there.
Is that legal? I ask. Two full-time jobs happening simultaneously seems like it might actually add up to two part-time jobs. Charlie drags a hand down his face as he sighs exhaustedly.
It's inadvisable, but my parents own this place and they needed help, so I've been running the shop for a few months while editing remotely.
He swipes the book off the counter.
You really buying this?
I like to support local businesses.
Good Books isn't so much a local business as it is a financial sinkhole, but I'm sure the tunnel inside the earth appreciates your money.
Excuse me, I say. Did you just say this place is called Good Books, as in your mother's last name, but also Good Book?
City people, he tuts. Never stop to smell the roses or look up to see the very prominently displayed signs over local businesses.
I wave a hand. Oh, I have the time. It's just that the Botox in my neck makes it hard to get my chin that high.
I've never met someone who is both so vain and so practical, he says, sounding just barely awed.
Which will be what actually goes on my headstone.
What a shame, he says, to waste all that on a pig farmer.
You're really hung up on the pig farmer, I say. Whereas Libby won't be satisfied with me dating anyone but a widowed single father who rejected a country music career to run a bed and breakfast.
He says, so you've met Randy?
I burst out laughing, and the corner of his mouth ticks. Oh, shit. It is a smile. He's pleased to have made me laugh, which makes my blood feel like maple syrup. And I hate maple syrup. I take a half step back, a physical boundary to accompany the mental one I'm trying to rebuild. Anyway, I heard a rumor you're hoarding the entire city's internet here.
You should never believe a small town rumor, Nora, he chides.
So?
The password is Good Books, he says. All lowercase, all one word, with the E on good.
He jerks his chin toward the cafe, brow arched.
Tell Principal Schroeder hi.
My face prickles. I look over my shoulder toward a wooden chair at the end of an aisle instead. On second thought, I'll just set up there. He leans forward, dropping his voice again.
Chicken.
His voice, the challenge of it, sends goosebumps rippling down my backbone. My competitive streak instantly activates, and I turn on my heel and march into the cafe, pausing beside the occupied table. You must be Principal Schroeder, I say, adding meaningfully. Charlie's told me so much about you. She seems flustered, almost knocking over her tea in her rush to shake my hand. You must be his girlfriend? She absolutely heard my comment about the ravishing and the hurricane. Oh, no, I say. We just met yesterday, but you come up a lot with him. I glance over my shoulder to see the look on Charlie's face, and no, I win this round.
I wouldn't call spending all day on your laptop 10 feet from your New York nemesis trying new things.
Libby is absolutely delighted by the dusty old shop, less so by its cashier.
The last thing you need is to spend this whole vacation immersed in your career.
I glance cautiously toward the doorway from the cafe, which sells only decaf and regular coffee, to the bookstore proper, making sure Charlie isn't within earshot.
I can't take a whole month off work. After 5 every day, I promise, I'm yours. You'd better be, she says. Because we have a list to get through, and that,
she tips her head in Charlie's general direction,
is a distraction. Since when am I distracted by men? I whisper. Have you met me? I'm here using the Wi-Fi, not giving out free lap dances. We'll see, she says tartly.
Like, give it 20 minutes and I will, in fact, be doling out lap dances in the local independent bookstore? She surveys our surroundings again, sighing wistfully.
I hate seeing bookstores empty.
Some of it might be the pregnancy hormones, but she's legitimately tearing up. It's expensive to keep shops like this up, I tell her, especially when so many people are turning to Amazon and other places that can afford to sell at a massive markdown. This kind of store is always the result of someone's dream, and, as with most dreams, it appears to be dying a slow, painful death.
Hey, Libby says, what about number 12?
At my blank stare, she adds, eyes sparkling,
save a local business. We should help this place.
And leave the sacrificial goats to fend for themselves? She swats me.
I'm serious.
I chance another glance in Charlie's general direction. They might not need our help. Or want it. She snorts.
I saw a copy of Everyone Poops shelved right next to a 1001 Chocolate Desserts cookbook.
Traumatizing, I agree with a shudder.
It'll be fun, Libby says. I already have ideas.